The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. Our special guest this Valentine's Day is poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy, whose love poems have just been collected into a new edition. They range from contemplation of an onion as the perfect Valentine's gift to Shakespeare's widow Anne Hathaway musing on the significance of that second best bed. But before her conversation with John Mullen, she opened with a poem about a lady's maid warming her mistress's pearls.
This poem is in the voice of a lady's maid. I had a wonderful friend called Judith Radstone, who used to work in Bernard Stone's wonderful turret books in London. And we were having a drink together one evening, and she told me that in Victorian times it was very common, if you were a rich woman and had a lady's maid, to give your pearls to the maid to wear during the day. Apparently the heat of the body improves the lustre of the pearl. And Judith told me this in a spirit of social outrage. She thought it was appalling. But I kind of sneakily thought that this was erotic and wrote this poem. And I think at this period in the 1980s, I was interested in voice, trying to find voices or language for the erotic or the hidden or the secret. Next to my own skin, her pearls. My mistress bids me wear them, warm them until evening when I'll brush her hair. At 6, I place them round her cool, white throat. All day I think of her, resting in the yellow room, contemplating silk or taffeta, which gown tonight. She fans herself whilst I work willingly, my slow heat entering each pearl, slack on my neck, her rope. She's beautiful. I dream about her in my attic bed, picture her dancing with tall men, puzzled by my faint, persistent scent beneath her friend's perfume, her milky stones. I dust her shoulders with a rabbit's foot, watch the soft blush seep through her skin like an indolent sigh. In her looking glass, my red lips part as though I want to speak. Full moon. Her carriage brings her home. I see her every movement in my head, undressing, taking off her jewels, her slim hand reaching for the case, slipping naked into bed the way she always does. And I lie here awake, knowing the pearls are cooling even now in the room where my mistress sleeps. All night, I feel their absence, and I burn. Well, I hope tomorrow you will have a very happy Valentine's Day. I'd like to read a poem called Valentine. I can't remember the circumstances of writing this poem, although I do remember that it wasn't about anyone and I didn't give it to anyone, and you'll see why when I read the poem. But I was thinking of the clichés of the Valentine, how we give the same old things year in, year out, and I wanted to find a more truthful object or image or metaphor to use. And I was writing at the time in my kitchen and my eye fell on an onion. I'm very fond of onions in many ways. I think they're very beautiful. And it seemed to me that the onion, like love, is lovely, but can often make us cry. And I remember actually peeling the onion when I had my notebook, so that the poem on the page, if you happen to see it, is meant to follow the unwrapping or the peeling of an onion. Not a red rose or a satin heart. I give you an onion. It is a moon wrapped in brown paper. It promises light like the careful undressing of love. Here, it will blind you with tears like a lover. It will make your reflection a wobbling photo of grief. I'm trying to be truthful, not a cute card or a kissogram. I give you an onion. Its fierce kiss will stay on your lips, possessive and faithful as we are, for as long as we are. Take it. Its platinum loops shrink to a wedding ring if you like. Lethal. Its scent will cling to your fingers, cling to your knife. I remember when I sent that poem off to be printed, that whoever was doing it thought I couldn't possibly mean an onion, so it was printed as, I give you an opinion. So that poem ends with the foreshadowing of the end of love, or perhaps even betrayal. And I'd like now to read a poem called Adultery. I think throughout the love poems I've written, I've been very interested in how one can find the right language to put in the scale of an abstract noun like desire or jealousy or passion. And I'm very much trying to do that in this poem, Adultery. Wear dark glasses in the rain. Regard what was unhurt as though through a bruise, guilt, a sick green tint. New gloves, money tucked in the palms, the handshake crackles. Hands can do many things, phone, open the wine, wash themselves. Now you are naked under your clothes all day, slim with deceit. Only the once brings you alone to your knees, miming more, more, older and sadder, creative. Suck a lie with a hole in it on the way home from a lethal, thrilling night up against a wall, faster. Language unpeels to a lost cry, you're a bastard. Do it, do it, do it. Sweet darkness in the afternoon, a voice in your ear telling you how you are wanted, which way now, a telltale clock wiping the hours from its face, your face on a white sheet, gasping, radiant, yes. Pay for it in cash, fiction, cab fares back to the life which crumbles like a wedding cake. Paranoia for lunch, too much to drink as a hand on your thigh tilts the restaurants. You know all about love, don't you? Turn on your beautiful eyes for a stranger who's dynamite in bed again and again, a slow replay in the kitchen where the slicing of innocent onions scald you to tears. Then selfish autobiographical sleep in a marital bed, the tarnished spoon of your body stirring betrayal, your heart overripe at the core. You're an expert, darling, your flowers dumb and explicit on nobody's birthday. So write the script, illness and debt, a ring thrown away in a garden no moon can heal, your own words commuting to bile in your mouth, terror, and all for the same thing twice, and all for the same thing twice. You did it. What? Didn't you? Fuck. Fuck. No. That was the wrong verb. This is only an abstract noun. Horrible poem. I can't think who I was when I wrote it. So here's a nice poem. A sonnet in the voice of Anne Hathaway, Shakespeare's widow. I think Shakespeare demonstrates in his sonnets that that's the perfect form for the love poem, the kind of little black dress of poetry, if you like. He was quite wealthy when he died. He returned to Stratford in his late 50s and was taken ill and died. He was a great owner of theatres here and property in Stratford. But when they opened the will to Anne, he'd just left an old piece of furniture, which he famously described as his second best bed. And many Shakespeare scholars have said that this was because he didn't love her anymore. That's why he was in London. He didn't live in Stratford. And he wanted to kind of insult her from beyond the grave by giving her this old bed. And I found that very hard to concur with. I think, although we know little of Shakespeare the man, his language is that of a generous, witty, playful, sexy, passionate man. I don't think he could be that petty or mean-spirited. And of course, he married Anne when he was a teenager. She was about 7 years old and was pregnant. So I decided this old bed was their first bed when he was a teenager, the bed that they first got it on, and that they would have been the only two people who knew this. Item, I give unto my wife my second best bed. The bed we loved in was a spinning world of forests, castles, torchlight, cliff tops, seas where he would dive for pearls. My lover's words were shooting stars, which fell to earth as kisses on these lips. My body now, a softer rhyme to his, now echo, assonance. His touch, a verb dancing in the centre of a noun. Some nights I dreamed he'd written me, the bed a page beneath his writer's hands, romance and drama played by touch, by scent, by taste. In the other bed, the best, our guests dozed on, dribbling their prose. My living, laughing love, I hold him in the casket of my widow's head, as he held me upon that next best bed. Okay, I'm just going now to read a handful of poems from a collection called Rapture, and that was a whole book of love poems, which followed the course of a love affair from its beginnings right through to its endings with all the events in between that. And I very much made use in these poems of the sonnet form. Sometimes formal sonnets, and in many of the poems there are flavourings or references or nods to great love poems of the past. I think really that all poets are essentially writing the same poem from Anon to Armitage, if you like. I think when we're born and work as poets, it's as though we pick up a needle and thread and begin continuing this very long tapestry which goes right back. So poets are connected through time, through language, forever. And by doing that, I think poets sing our human music for us. Of course, nowadays we are more likely to get a text than a poem. And I was thinking about this in this poem, Text. I turn the mobile now like an injured bird. We text, text, text our significant words. I reread your first, your second, your third. Look for your small X, X, feeling absurd. The codes we send arrive with a broken cord. I try to picture your hands, their image is blurred. Nothing my thumbs press will ever be heard. And this poem is called Tea. I kept all the poems in Rapture as far as I could down to one word titles because I wanted each poem to sort of boil down to the incident that prompted the poem. I like pouring your tea, lifting the heavy pot and tipping it up so the fragrant liquid steams in your china cup. Or when you're away or at work, I like to think of your cupped hands as you sip, as you sip of the faint half-smile of your lips. I like the questions, sugar, milk, and the answers I don't know by heart yet, for I see your soul in your eyes and I forget. Jasmine, gunpowder, Assam, Earl Grey, Ceylon, I love tea's names. Which tea would you like, I say, but it's any tea for you, please, any time of day, as the women harvest the slopes for the sweetest leaves on Mount Wu Yi. And I'm your lover, smitten, straining your tea. And I think often we want to say more than we ever can, almost as though there isn't the language in existence. And in this poem, I can't find it in my present, so I turn back and trying to find it in the past. And I'll just read two more poems exploring that idea. Syntax. I want to call you thou, the sound of the shape of the start of a kiss like this, thou, and to say after, I love, thou, I love, thou I love, not I love you. Because I so do, as we say now, I want to say thee, I adore thee, and to know in my lips the syntax of love resides, and to gaze in thine eyes. Love's language starts, stops, starts, the right words flowing or clotting in the heart. And finally, it's a poem called The Love Poem, and on one level, the poem is about the end of this relationship. But it's also about the end of language, the end of the ability to say anything. And in the poem, I call on other great love poets to support me, to stand behind me. Till love exhausts itself, longs for the sleep of words, my mistress eyes, to lie on a white sheet at rest in the language, let me count the ways, or shrink to a phrase like an epitaph, come live with me, or fall from its own high cloud as syllables in a pool of verse, 1 hour with thee. Till love gives in and speaks in the whisper of art, dear heart, how like you this? Love's lips pursed, quotation marks kissing a line, look in thy heart and write. Love's light fading, darkening, black as ink on a page, there is a garden in her face. Till love is all in the mind, oh my America, my new found land, or all in the pen in the writer's hand, behold, thou art fair, not there, except in a poem, known by heart like a prayer, both near and far, near and far, the desire of the moth for the star.
Thanks very much. Carol Ann has said if we're very good, she might read another poem at the end. Your accounts of how they arose were all sort of quite contrary, I suppose. Do you think contrariness is one of your poetic inclinations when you write about love?
I think what happens when a poem is prompted, I always feel it to be how it might feel to be an oyster, in that there's a grit, and that piece of grit might be being told something like, isn't it awful that a woman had to worm her pearls? And you might, or I might think, oh, well, no, but. And then the pearl of the poem kind of swirls around the grit, the same with the onion. So it's more a way of seeing which isn't necessarily contrary, but occurs. You know, Picasso and Braque, when they began the early Cubist paintings, were seeing genuinely in a fresh way. And I think poetry does that with language. That we don't just look straight on and go, yes, that's wrong, or that's just a vegetable. There's a way of experiencing the world poetically, I think.
That onion poem, when you talked about it, you made it sound quite a sort of, perhaps a jaundiced poem, but I when I was reading it, I was thinking, God, yes, she can make the onion a really good metaphor for love, actually. I mean, if you're a good poet, you can do that. You can sort of take anything, really.
I don't know. I often wonder what would have happened if there had been, like, a cucumber there. Or
aubergine, I mean...
aubergine would be okay. Yeah, they're sexy. Yeah. The joy of being a poet, as well as the joy of reading poetry, is this sense of an invisible companion. So there's always... Yes, the everyday when you're in the kitchen and cooking and or chatting or whatever, but there's this other way of being, which is to do with seeing and striving for the language that balances that seeing. And I think with love, which I suppose the love poem along with the elegy are the two great pillars of English poetry, there's always a desire to make the common uncommon in language. In our dialogue in the Guardian, which I've cut out.
Oh, but, my God. Yeah.
Not so keen on yours. I quote Samuel Beckett's wonderful poem in 1936, a wonderful poem called Cascando. And he writes, and this is the beginning of the poem, the churn of stale words in the heart again, love, 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 thud of the old plunger, pestling the unutterable way of words. So if you think, you know, nearly 100 years ago, Samuel Beckett was struggling with how to write a love poem.
Yeah, the poem you read at the end, in which is sort of braided with those quotations, famous quotations from famous love poems. And the last one, the Shelley one, The Moth Drawn to the Stars. Mm. And actually, that's a poem which actually starts, I think, saying, one word is too often profaned for me to profane it. So it's a love poem which starts actually saying, and that word presumably is love,
yes.
So and he's also not even going to use it.
You can read it not only as the lover to the beloved, but the poet to the poem as well.
I mean, that feels like quite a risky sort of device to use in that last poem, using such electric quotations.
Well, I think every poem is risk. That's why poets continue to write poetry. It's can I get across the tightrope to the other side? And poems are also acts of love in themselves. I think any good or great poem is adding something to the world. It's giving a moment of consolation or a moment of joy or a moment of celebration or a moment of empathy to the world. We wouldn't live in the same world if we didn't have Shakespeare's sonnets or Pablo Neruda's love poems or Adrienne Rich's poems or... you know, Seamus Heaney's poems, the world would be less. So poems are givings.
Well, it's time for them to give now.
At what age did you begin writing poetry and what influenced you?
I probably started writing poems when I was about 10, largely because it was my favourite lesson at school, English. And I had a really lovely... teacher called Mrs. Tilsher. In fact, I've written a poem about her called In Mrs. Tilsher's Class, and you can read that And one day she typed some of my poems for me, sort of four poems, and put them together with a shoelace. And I remember the importance of this because suddenly my poems weren't in my own child handwriting. They were separate from me. They were in print. They were published. So that was hugely important. And then when I went to big school, I went to a convent, but the convent had some teachers who came in who weren't nuns. And I had a fantastic teacher there called Miss Scriven, who was quite a sort of Jean Brodie character, and she didn't like the teaching at the convent, which is very narrow, so she would bring in her own books. And I think the first poets that she gave to me that I could take home were poets like Dylan Thomas, Allen Ginsberg, Rilke, Neruda, just a kind of quite eclectic selection of Penguin 60s paperbacks. So I would just read all of these and copy them.
So you did copy them?
Yeah, I think we learn by imitation. So there wasn't any one poem, just all of it. And I think it was falling in love, actually, that made me take poetry really seriously, because I started writing love poems when I was about 15.
And delivering them?
Oh, no.
What's your favourite poem that you've either read or written or both?
My favourite poem that I don't think I've got it here, actually, is a poem I wrote about my daughter when she was sleeping, aged two. I think you don't have to have children yourself to know this, but if you've ever looked after a child, even in their... and asleep very young, there's a wonderful moment where you stand looking at them. And as I was doing this with my daughter, her bedroom window had the moon in it, so it was as though the moon was looking at me, looking at her, kind of triangle. And her face was lit in some way. So that's called A Child's Sleep.
Yeah, a lot of the poems are quite personal to you, but I think that they become quite personal to us. How do you feel when someone reads something in it or takes ownership of a poem that was obviously about your life and either you don't agree with it or it wasn't what you intended, particularly obviously in the love poems?
Well, you remember when I was saying when my teacher typed these poems, they immediately went away from me. It was almost as though they'd been put on a little stream and were bobbing away just simply by being depersonalised. They weren't in my handwriting anymore, they were typed, they were bound. And I think my involvement or any poet's involvement with the poem is at the time of writing it, when I'm alone at home with my pen and my notebook. That's the very personal giving of self. But then there are quite hard-headed or pragmatic decisions that are made in poems, like words will be changed. It might be that in real life the event took place in summer, but it's better for the poem that it's snowing. So lies go on and fictions, although the heart of the poem is true. So the more crafted the poem becomes, the further away it goes. And then it's owned by the reader.
Carolan, you've talked a lot about the personal up to now. Can I now turn to the public and be a little bit more serious? Your title up there is Poet Laureate.
Well, I love being Poet Laureate for many, many reasons. Most importantly, I think, because it's the first time we've had a woman Poet Laureate. I suppose the main reason... having consulted my daughter, I said yes. And I think poetry is our national art, and I would want poetry to be present at all national circumstances and to have a clamour of different poetic voices is very important. And I've been so lucky with The Guardian, who've given so many of their pages to publishing many different poems on many different subjects. really, and I'd hope to continue to do that.
Following on sort of from that point and about women poets, sort of one of the things that I treasure in your poetry is that it gives expression to something feminine. But I just wondered if you had any thoughts or comments on how you see yourself as with that feminine voice. If you consider yourself, I'm just a poet and my gender is not important, or if that was something, you know, as you've written, you've felt strongly about or experienced a kind of pushing for recognition in that way.
The fact that I'm a woman is completely important. I mean, it's who I am, and I think when I said earlier poetry I feel is the music of being human, I'm a female human, and I want to write out of, if you like, my body, and that includes having given birth. It includes political experiences as a woman. So it isn't a conscious decision, it's natural as breathing. I think the poetic tradition is more complex because we have so many, if you like, invisible women poets, you know, who aren't part of the canon that perhaps we haven't read or aren't there to be read. So the tradition is very male. But if we look even in our own country at the number of women, good women poets now writing, there are probably more good women poets now writing than there are good male poets, arguably.
Discuss.
Do you sometimes think that because you've written so many poems that maybe one that you took great care in writing maybe loses its importance because there are so many others written that it just becomes another poem?
I think at the time of writing a poem, that's, I suppose, when it's most alive, because there's the complete giving of the self through language to the poem. And I noticed when I was rereading these love poems, I think I said it was a case of emotion totally forgotten in tranquility, to kind of misquote Wordsworth. So a poem like Words Wide Night, and I can remember where I was when I wrote this. It was in the 1980s in a B&B in Bolton. Really writing this poem and feeling it and meaning it. And I think it's an okay poem. I don't think it's one of my best poems. I think it's an okay poem. But for me, as the author of it, reading it now, it's like used chewing gum.
What's your opinion on your representation of men and your treatment of men in your poems?
Is there a particular... there's lots, aren't there?
I guess lots of people say that you're quite man-hating, so I just wanted to know what you thought about that.
I think mostly that's a question that comes up with The World's Wife. Mm. And for those of you who don't know that book, it takes all the stories that I love from childhood, stories from fairy tales, like Little Red Riding Hood, or mythology like Midas and Orpheus. sometimes the movies like King Kong, or popular culture like the Kray Twins. And what I try to do is celebrate, and I do think poetry is always a celebration, always a gift. Never its opposite. It's always an adding. Poetry takes nothing away. And I wanted to find a female truth in all of these very familiar stories and characters. So sometimes that might have meant debunking or ridiculing or teasing or turning things on their head. But I think the impulse was, at its very least, always affectionate. For instance, the poem Anne Hathaway is a poem from The World's Wife, and that's a hugely loving sonnet. I have four brothers. My partner has a little boy. My best friends are men. You know, I love men. So to reduce any poet's work to that kind of label, I think, is silly.
I studied your poems at GCSE, and one of my favourite ones was Education for Leisure. And I read a couple of years ago that they took it off the GCSE syllabus because it featured a knife. And I was just wondering how you felt about that and how you deal with criticism.
Well, it was a very old poem. It was a poem over 25 years old. And I'd written it at the time when Meryl Streep was Prime Minister. I wish. It was a pro-education, anti-unemployment poem, looking at what might happen if we didn't invest in our young people's futures. And the poem ended with the image of a teenage boy taking a knife from his mother's kitchen. And an invigilator read the poem during the exam and decided that I had written the poem in order to incite knife crime in the young. She wrote to her MP, and in those two steps, the poem was removed, the anthology shredded and reprinted, and where my poem had been, it said, "This page has deliberately been left blank." And the wonderful Guardian rang me up to tell me this. And I wrote a poem in response. So perhaps I'll finish with that. So this was the reply to the banned poem. And it's nice to read this because it returns again to Shakespeare and to the sonnet form. Mrs. Schofield's GCSE. "You must prepare your bosom for his knife," said Portia to Antonio in which of Shakespeare's comedies. "Who killed his wife insane with jealousy, and which Scots witch knew something wicked this way comes? Who said, 'Is this a dagger which I see?'" Which tragedy? "Whose blade was drawn which led to Tybalt's death? To whom did dying Caesar say, 'Et tu?' And why? Something is rotten in the state of Denmark. Do you know what this means? Explain how poetry pursues the human like the smitten moon above the weeping, laughing earth, how we make prayers of it. Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again. Said by which king? You may begin."
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.